My lords and members of the House of Commons, my government's overriding priority.
Well, Her Majesty spoke for just 7 minutes, but we've got a full 20 to chew over her words.
Madeleine Bunting, Michael White and Martin Kettle are joining us for Politics Weekly today to pick apart the government's plans.
There was something for the old, something for the young, and also a promise of how they'd pay for it all, although they didn't quite explain how.
But we're not going to start there. We're going to start with what was not in it. Cameron was very angry immediately after the Queen's speech. There was nothing on expenses. And then a few hours later, the civil servant who'd been charged with reforming expenses also said that he was annoyed by the absence of anything on expenses. Mike, what's happened? Has there been something of, dare I say, a coordinated move between the Tories and the civil servant?
Well, David Cameron was on the Today programme Thursday morning, and was, I thought, a bit nimble-footed about that. He didn't say there hadn't been, and he said he'd certainly check. He couldn't say for sure. But when I watched Christopher Kelly, former Permanent Secretary of the Department of Health, delivering his report a few days ago at, I think, the National Liberal Club, redolent of Victorian grandeur, I thought, this chap's quite pleased with himself. He's smart and evidently decent, but he's politically naive, and I think he had no business to chip in like that. There are plenty of... There's a respectable case for saying there is no need to put anything in the Queen's speech. We will respond. Parliament will respond when Sir Ian Kennedy, who's the chairman of this new body called IPSA, the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority, I think I've got that... When he's sort of gone through Kelly, do you remember Kelly got sniffy when Kennedy said, "I may not do all of these things of Sir Christopher Kelly," and it may be. In David Cameron's case, it's straight political intelligence. He's been very cute on this. He's been very quick off the ball. And whether or not he believes it, I don't know, but he always sounds good. But I think the government, needless to say, was back-footed and issued a hasty statement last evening. Mm. He's a very slow learner, Gordon Brown, isn't he? Really slow.
Martin, is Kelly fallen in step with the Tories?
I think, you know, they're marching to the same drum, but I don't think necessarily they're kind of doing hand in hand. I think, you know, Mike's obviously right that there is a respectable case for saying it doesn't need to be in the Queen's speech, but politically, it's dumb. It's just really dumb. Not to have got that onto the table in some way or other is foolish. Now, there was an opportunity, a clear opportunity to do that. In his party conference speech, Brown talked about introducing the possibility of a recall election for corrupt or, I think, otherwise... It's not just corrupt MPs, but
dodgy.
Some other dodgy ones will do.
People who vote against the sun. Yeah.
Now, that, I think... That would certainly require some sort of legislation. And, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing he could have put in the Queen's speech, but didn't.
But Madeleine, sort of apart from sort of the possibilities of the imagination, in terms of Kelly's ideas, it's right that they're independent. I mean, they were set up to be independent, and can't you see a respectable case for why the government thought that it had given IPSA its task and sort of that was the end of that? Not is it just us that care about this, and actually do people outside not care that there was nothing in the Queen's speech about
it? They don't
expenses?
Care as much as we tell each other they care. A lot of MPs say it's not raised on the doorstep, and I think it's done Parliament a lot of harm, but it's not quite as important to voters as, you know, jobs in the economy and getting a mortgage and all the bread and butter stuff.
I'm not sure about that, Mike. It seems to me, I mean, one kind of wonders what doorsteps we've both been standing on, because it does seem to me that people are very, very upset about this. What I think they've kind of glazed out on completely is the kind of technology of how you actually do it. Is it independent? Is it Kelly? The sort of squabbling as they see it. And that's the problem. Complex reforms like this are always difficult. They require a lot of debate and negotiation.
But it's
and
driven by populism.
Hang on a second. It's just that people don't actually have the stomach to follow the kind of ups and downs of this complicated negotiation. So that's the bit they've lost interest in. What they've walked away from already from this story, they've walked away with a sense of profound kind of dissatisfaction with politicians.
So who's responsible for that? We are at least 50%.
Well, that's true. I mean, certainly the media is very much part of the problem, and that's undoubtedly the case. But the real difficulty, I think, with all this is, you know, at the bottom of all this is the fact that Gordon Brown, I think, mentally, he thinks he's dealt with this problem and he now wants to move on. And that, if you like, is the subtext of the whole Queen's speech and the political situation. He wants he thinks people follow politics sufficiently closely to be persuadable and comfortable with the idea that there was a problem on expenses. It's now been dealt with. Now on to real politics. That's Brown's mentality, and I think he just is a tinier for the popular conversation, whether it's populist or whether it's just being emotionally insensitive.
I think Martin's raising a really important point, actually. It immediately reminds me of the whole treatment of the Iraq War. I remember Tessa Jowell, repeatedly saying to me, let's move on. And moving on, which after all, let's remember, is a sort of pop psychology phrase, has been a really key part of how New Labour has tried to put problems behind it, but has always then been leaving unaddressed the way the public conversation actually still is embroiled in things that they're very unhappy about.
Okay, I'm going to take Tessa Jowell's advice and just for a very short second move on. That was what wasn't in the Queen's speech, but here is our poll.
Polly Toynbee, that is.
With what was in the Queen's speech.
At the end of a Parliament, Queen's speeches are always a bit odd because you know that all those bills are not going to get through. What this said was, not dead yet. Here was Labour's programme. A lot of it will be in the manifesto. Things it still wants to do. It wants to show that it's still got plenty of ideas and still plenty of life left in it, despite three long terms.
Through active employment and training programmes, restructuring the financial sector, strengthening the national infrastructure, and providing responsible investment, my government will foster growth and employment.
The most important thing of all in there, possibly a kind of tombstone, is the commitment to cut all the deficit within 4 years. It's putting handcuffs on this Chancellor, on any future Chancellor, to say you must hit that target. Of course, the Conservatives are going even farther. They're saying we will outdo that target. But it's, Brown had to break his own previous golden rule. What do you do if you put it in law? Does it really make a difference? It is a very firm commitment.
My government is committed to ensuring everyone has a fair chance in life and will continue to take forward legislation to promote equality, narrow the gap between rich and poor, and tackle discrimination.
Gordon Brown's in a place now where it's very difficult to change the political weather. It's very difficult to be heard. A whole range of very good practical things that people will like. They will like the idea their children can get one-to-one tuition if they fall behind at school. They'll like the idea that you get free social care if you're really, really sick at home. But it's very hard to make much impact or to get much traction when the perception is you're on the way out, the polls are all against you, Cameron's going to be the next leader anyway. Are people listening? That's Labour's problem, to be heard.
Mike, heard or not, how much of this is going to get through?
Oh, not much.
Which would you say will get through?
I haven't a clue. Don't care much. To be honest, it's a fag end of a government. It isn't really going anywhere. We all revere Polly Toynbee, but I thought she'd let her cousin Pollyanna get hold of the typewriter yesterday. And the more fundamental critique is, which she glosses over, is of course you can't legislate to halve the deficit in 4 years. It's not what it's about. It's about raising taxes or cutting expenditure. It's easy to say it. It's very difficult to do. Of course you can't legislate to guarantee that certain things happen to people in the NHS or in schools either. It's, as both Charles Clark and Michael Howard said in the Commons debate last night, merely a recipe for making lawyers, the kind of people who don't need Polly Toynbee's help, even richer than they are.
It's a complete misconception
what they ought to be doing. It's very Gordon.
Okay, so Clegg said that it should have been cancelled. Madeline, should they just, dare I say it, the Queen was disturbed for 7 minutes. What was the point?
Well, I think I sort of have some sympathy for Polly's position. Mike was a bit dismissive, calling it Pollyanna-ish. And I think to raise the possibility of these types of things, one-on-one tuition, care for the... I mean, I'm very torn between them because I can't bear all this guarantee stuff. I can't bear the legal language. I think, this is a desperate government that spent 10 years trying to reform public services and it's now snatching at another crazy idea. Targets drove us all nuts and the idea of guarantees...
The NHS have been brilliant.
But Martin, she's right, isn't she? That it's kind of, it's almost about trust. It's about we've been saying it for so long and now we have to resort to legal language to prove we really mean it.
Well, I think that the target era has come to an end And that's why, that's one of the reasons that they've tried to come up with another mechanism for public service delivery. There's a lot of things, you know, there's a big backstory there that one can get into. But, I mean, I think that the fact that they've introduced this approach could actually be a, you know, if those laws do get onto the statute book, and if they if they're not removed by the next government, I mean, that's a, it does, as Mike said, open up a huge vista of litigation and a much greater role for the courts in enforcing rights. Now, in other areas, yes, but in other yeah. areas, we're all in favour of that, aren't we? We're all in favour of the courts, you know, rescuing us from from government actions that we disapprove of, you know, and it's a very important, you know, it's, well, it's a fundamental rule of law.
Not the ones we approve of.
No, I would really disagree that we all approve of that, Martin. I mean, if you look, for example, at the way a midwife has to spend almost a half of their time in a delivery room filling in notes because of the danger of legal action afterwards, I think that there's something kind of profoundly wrong about bringing law into every aspect of the public service professional's
Professor Tom,
life.
You spent most of yesterday looking into this for the leader, didn't you? What did you come up with?
Well, I mean, for a start, I think some of it will happen because it's secondary legislation. That means ministers have already given themselves the power to bring some of this stuff in, and the NHS in particular. So whether or not new bills go through, they've already got the power to do some of it. One thing I'm struck by is the contrast with the climate change bill, which most of us in Guardian Towers were in favour of. And of course, David Cameron was very much in favour of. And what I'm struggling to see is why it's good to have a bill that says, yes, the Prime Minister and the government must come to account and explain to the House of Commons why they're missing their Kyoto targets, but why it would be a bad thing for them to do the same thing in respect to child poverty. And that seems to me, Mike, where the Conservatives are.
Well, there are different things. There's legislating that these targets, if you rescind them, then that sort of says something about any future government you form. But then there's the guarantees, and they're different things, aren't they? And you guys are talking about...
Yeah, absolutely. Child poverty, the Tories are accepting the idea of committing to a target on child poverty.
Well, they're accepting
legislation change. Is nothing.
But are they really going to let it go through the House of Lords? I don't think so.
I do. Because
they've said they won't play politics with it.
It's an elephant trap which Gordon has cunningly, all the elephants can see it, but nonetheless he likes it, cunningly set for
and because
them.
It's a 2020 target, Tom, it's something that they think is a far enough away problem that they sort of, they're kind of having to rescind it or not.
Dan Hannum will be Prime Minister by then.
I mean, both child poverty and climate change, yeah. You know, putting these kinds of targets into legislation seems to me to be not a bad idea, but unlikely to have much impact. What I think is much more problematic is these vague kind of guarantees of a good quality education. Boy, oh boy, do I see this causing havoc.
Yep.
Every single parent at the school gate who's complaining about a teacher now will feel entitled, and it'll be the middle classes. We'll take those cases to the courts.
Madeline, on that, because we had to delve around and talk to lawyers about this yesterday, and they're split. So one QC was saying, yeah, big time, more money for lawyers. Lord Leicester was saying that the Joint Committee on Human Rights have looked into it, and actually they think that if a service can prove they've tried to provide a service, then they can't be done.
But how well, does
we don't
the,
know
how
that
do they prove
yet.
That?
Well, that's right.
So they have to go to court to prove it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So you've got teachers, the head teachers, sitting in courts defending the quality of the education delivered in their schools instead of running their blooming schools.
Against monstrous parents.
Martin, can you inject some balance here?
Well,
be a monstrous parent.
I don't know. I mean, what I think about this is that in general terms, I think we are in the Western world, largely perhaps on the American example, but also, you know, to put it in a historical context, I think it's, you know, the legacy of the Enlightenment. We have this sense that we want a permanent constitution which embodies certain rights, and that these rights, if they're not delivered by government, can be delivered by the courts. Now, in lots of other areas of our life, we are, you know, we depend upon that, and we see this as very virtuous. In other countries, the kind of thing that's got Madeline hot under the collar would be dealt with through the courts without the kind of anger and hysteria that she's talking about. Sometimes there is lots of anger and hysteria, you know, and often with some justification, but mostly not. And, you know, if you're entitled to something, you've got to have the right to enforce it. If otherwise, it's not a right. And you know, a right that's unenforceable is nonsense. So
yeah.
I don't see what
it's a Soviet
I don't.
Right.
I do not see what is inherently wrong with this. What I do dislike about it, and I think is very the government's very vulnerable about, you know, too, is that so much of what is in this Queen's speech has not been thought through properly. The classic example of that is this row about the social care budget, but there are plenty of others too. You know, where quite clearly nobody's really done the sums as to what is involved. Michael White, taking part in this conversation, wrote a really interesting piece in Thursday's paper exactly about this, and you know, that's the bit that I think is undermines the credibility of an approach to the enforcement of rights, which I'm otherwise extremely comfortable with, being a liberal.
Isn't there a bit of a difference, though, between the sort of things that we call rights that are in the, I don't know, the American Bill of Rights or the Human Rights Act, which is the right not to be messed around with, and these types of rights, which are really about how government spends money. Government will provide you with X, Y, Z.
Negative rights versus positive rights.
Because it's about resources, and if the government spends money on one thing, it's not spending it on another. Whereas if it doesn't tap your phone, it doesn't mean
it has to tap someone else's. If you talk to ministers about this, Tom, and you've obviously done it too, they'll say, no, we're not going to let the courts allocate resources. And historically, the courts have been reluctant to do that because they recognise that's part of the democratic process. And they back off. They tend to support NICE, which, again, has rejected an over-expensive drug for the NHS, quite rightly, in my view, today. They don't say, it's not our job to allocate resources. That's between the government and the electorate. But we're tiptoeing carelessly, I think, into dangerous ground.
I think it could be dangerous. I think it's really interesting and really important ground, and to that extent I think that what the government's doing is something we should, at the very least we should be talking about. I just underline something Mike said earlier? He made a reference to what Michael Howard said in the Queen's speech debate yesterday. It was a really interesting speech, and where he was talking about the encroachment of the courts on the political process over the period that he's been in Parliament. I mean, I don't agree with him about what he said, but it's a very interesting argument, and it's certainly one that it reflected well, I thought, on Parliament, which gets such a bad press. But it was having these. I thought the Queen's speech debate yesterday was really excellent in quality terms, and there were some really thoughtful contributions.
Can I just return everyone to the beginning of the week, Urs? Certainly before the Queen's speech, when Cameron was accusing the government, having read all the trails of what was going to be in the Queen's speech, accusing the government of electioneering. And I sort of found this weird. It's like, you know, politics in politics. Why has that attack got any traction? Of course it's electioneering.
Politics is... You know, politics is unpopular. Nobody likes
politics.
Of course, it's a preposterous attack. I mean,
it's politics.
You know, it's politics. I mean, you know, it's the kind of H.M. Bateman cartoon of the MP who mentioned the election during the Queen's speech debate. Shock, horror, everybody.
I think the trouble is
all over the place.
I think it looks too transparently political.
Well, more than other Queen's speeches, Mike.
Well, it's just a bit thin, and they're tired, and it's an attempt to curry favour. A lot of the bills there's one about seeing the position of agency workers, right? And you think, oh, well, that's interesting, but it's, you know, they're ticking off an electoral box. Some of the things which haven't been publicised, incidentally, an MP was absolutely thrilled about the Flood and Water Management Bill, which the government has failed to publicise. All those floods, they're going to do something practical about it. My MP said, people who live in houses built since 1936, did you lot of clever clogs know this? I didn't. Many of them are responsible for the sewage and the drains out to the middle of the road. They're roads which were never adopted for drains and sewage purposes. People don't know that. And when they get flooded, they find out all right when the sewage backwashes, and that's going to be put right, and the local authorities' role is going to be made clearer. And you think, oh, that's jolly good. 5 million people were flooded two years ago. But has the government machine managed to make anything of it? Nope.
Madeline, what would you have liked to have seen in this week's Queen's speech?
Well, it's quite a good question, actually, because it makes you realise the extent to which he's sort of ticked the boxes of people like me. International development, child poverty, climate change, flood and water management, actually, as well.
Yeah, yeah.
A happy customer.
But I think I so profoundly disagree with Martin on that issue. I think there are already all kinds of legal safeguards about the quality of services. You can already take your local authority to court if you feel that child's not had a proper education. So what I think really is damaging about this speech is just that the carelessness, you know, Mike got it right, treading into sort of dangerous waters with a kind of bravado and sort of insouciance, which I find very irritating.
I've never heard of Gordon accused of bravado.
I'm amazed to hear such a root and branch attack on the rule of law. I don't see that.
No, it's not. It's not the rule of law, and it's in danger of bringing the rule of law
Anarchist
into disrepute.
Okay, well, that's enough Queen for one programme. And I also need to mention our Politics Weekly show with a live audience, and that audience could have you in it if you want. It's on Wednesday, the 9th of December at 7 o'clock, and will come from the Scott Room here at Guardian HQ.
Polly Toynbee, Simon Jenkins and Nick Cohen will be on the panel with us. And to get your tickets, just email politics.weekly@guardian.co.uk.
That is it for this week. Thank you to Michael White, Martin Kettle and Madeline Bunting, that's a lot of M's, for joining us in the podcast this week. Thank you also to Francesca Panessa, as always, for producing.
And we'll be back next week. And until then, goodbye.